Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Have you ever experienced a dry, itchy scalp or ever wondered why your color isn't lasting as long as your hairdresser promised? Well, unfiltered, mineral-filled water could be the reason why. Did you know hard water is a leading cause of damaged hair and dry, irritated skin? And that about 85% of the United States uses hard water, filled with dissolved minerals and added chlorine. That's where Canopy's new filtered shower head comes in. Canopy, known for their beauty hacks and reimagined humidifier, has revolutionized the filtered shower head. Dermatologists recommended this unique three-stage filtration system greatly reduces contaminants and odors in your shower water, leaving you with healthy hair and glowing skin. Best of all, the Canopy filtered shower head is hassle-free. Installation is a breeze. We put it in, it took like 30 seconds, guys. And its unique quick-release filter replacement feature allows for seamless filter replacement unlike any others on the market. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy filtered shower head purchase today with Canopy's hassle-free filter subscription. Even better, our listeners can use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Hurry, your hair and skin will thank you.
I love spring. I feel like it's the perfect time to hit reset. Get rid of the things that don't work, bring in things that do work. With Nextivo Naturals CBD products, you can get rid of oil-based CBD, which doesn't work very well, and introduce CBD that will help you live well, happily, with less stress and greater sleep quality. Oil-based CBD just doesn't mix well with our bodies because our bodies are mostly water. But Nextivo Naturals developed a clinically tested, water-soluble form of CBD, and their gummies and capsules are proven to work faster and absorb better than oil-based products. For a limited time in April, you can get 60% off an order of $40 or more by using code PANTSUIT at Nextivo.com. I really value the sleep complex. It is CBD with melatonin, and it just helps take the edge off my day when my thoughts are racing as I hit the pillow. I can just kind of feel myself melting away. I wake up refreshed. I sleep all night. I think it is such a good product that has been, for years now, really valuable to me. Give your life a refresh with more effective and fast-acting CBD from Nextivo Naturals. For a limited time in April, get 60% off any order of $40 or more by using code PANTSUIT at Nextivo.com. That's 60% off any order of $40 or more only in April at Nextivo.com with promo code PANTSUIT.
I spoke at the Women's March, and someone told me they thought what I said was really controversial. Here's what I said. So we need to seek to understand. There are a lot of people who are hurting, and they voted for Donald Trump because they're hurting, and they didn't think that the traditional Democrats had a plan. Why was that? What specifically is hurting them, and how do we make sure that as we engage with people, we stay tethered to the things that really improve people's lives?
This is Sarah.
And Beth.
You're listening to Pantsuit Politics,
the home of grace-filled political conversations.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Pantsuit Politics. We are thrilled to be with you here today and share our interview with Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan. We had a truly delightful conversation with her that I cannot wait for all of you to listen to. Unfortunately, we are going to spend the first half of the show on the very difficult, heartbreaking, soul-wrenching story coming out of Minneapolis about the death of George Floyd. Before we get to the interview, and before we dive into that headline, we did want to share that we're still accepting business stories. So if you run a small business, or really any kind of business, and you've had struggles, interactions with the federal government over the PPP program, or just particular COVID-related challenges as a business owner, we would love to hear from you. If you want to record a short 2 to 3 minute voice memo and email it to hello@pantsuitpoliticsshow.com, we're going to put those together in an episode along the lines of the kid episode and the personal experience with COVID-19 episode we've done over the last few weeks.
Well, as we start to discuss the murder of George Floyd, I think it is important to step back and look at the context for the country that we are still mourning the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, that we are still pursuing justice in that case, that we are still mourning and pursuing justice in the case of Breonna Taylor, that just this week we have the story of the Central Park incident in which a white woman, Amy Cooper, called the police about a black man who was bird watching in the park and used language suggesting that she in fact intended to use his race against him in that altercation. And now we have another traumatic video so similar to what happened to Eric Garner in New York that it is eerie. And another man dead because police approached him about suspicion that he used a counterfeit $20 bill in a store.
There are so many layers of this that make it particularly excruciating that we saw this tragedy unfold with Eric Garner using the same exact words that George Floyd uses to plead for his life, which is, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. That it wasn't under any scenario a situation in which the police should have been fearing for their life. It was a minor infraction. He was unarmed. He was handcuffed. I think the fact that you can hear the bystanders around George Floyd filming this situation, pleading for his life. You hear a first responder, a female who works for the Minneapolis Fire Department, using her expertise and position as best she can to plead for this man's life, to say, check his pulse. He's unconscious. Get off him. I mean, you can, in every way, watch the death of this man on the street unfold in a completely preventable way, right in front of your eyes. It is one of the most heart-wrenching things I have ever seen. I not only pray for his family and his community, I pray for the people surrounding him in that moment who are most surely traumatized witnessing a murder right in front of their eyes and putting it on top of not just the most recent tragedies, but the filming of these tragedies over the last 10 years. I think it is reaching, I pray to God, a critical mass of people where we are recognizing the cancer in our culture, in our society, in our policies, not in individual hearts and minds. This is everyone's problem. This man's death is on all of us. And I think that is what is so excruciating, is because it feels like in 2020, this should not have happened. And yet, here we are, not shocked, which makes it even worse. And it's horrific. It's nauseating. And I hear it in a lot of people. I feel like I pray that this is affecting more people and affecting more white people and affecting white people more deeply, more emotionally, so that we can, you know, stop being blind to all of this.
And we have to be careful in expressing that, that we don't make it about us as white people.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is work that is ours to do as white people, to be sure. But a lot of that work is not public work. And I think a lot of white people believe that their work to do on this is public work. Our public work is listening. Our public work is talking with the people in our communities, in our spheres of influence. But our social media kind of outrage, and particularly our inclination toward, please give me a list of things I need to go do now to make my grief better. And I do not believe that's everyone's intention. And I am not criticizing people who want a list of things to do. But I think it is important to pay attention to how we come across to our loved ones who are Black and brown people living with this in a much different way than we have to live with it as white people. You know, the things that make this even more excruciating from my perspective, in addition to what you mentioned, Sarah, is that there were other officers standing there. Mm-hmm. As a bystander, what are you to do other than what those bystanders did? Film it, say something, mm-hmm. plead, do everything that you can, but recognize that you too are on the other end of force that is disproportionate here.
I mean, you could hear somebody say, what are we supposed to do? Call the police on the police?
Right.
You hear somebody say that in the video.
And those police officers standing there watching this did not have that risk. They had mm-hmm. the equal force of their colleague who was doing this and chose to do nothing. And I worry that the reporting about how this particular officer has a history of violence, has had fines imposed, that we knew that this individual has a deep propensity toward abusing his power, will make this an individual issue instead of us realizing that, no, it's a systemic issue, that we still have an officer on active duty like that. Mm-hmm. It's a systemic issue that we always want to litigate the facts of these individual cases. We should not need a video showing us this to believe now that there are officers out there abusing their power against Black men in particular, but against communities in general. There's a document compiled by an organization in Minnesota about the people who have lost their lives to police. The document that we found runs through 2018. It is a huge, diverse list of people. It's a huge list of human beings who in senseless encounters with the police ended up dead. And this is not to say that police officers as individuals are bad people. It is to say that we have a problem around how we think about policing in general across this country. It differs community to community. There are communities who are working really hard on this, in part because they themselves have experienced senseless, tragic deaths. But we got to ask ourselves, why are we arming our police officers as though they are going to war every day? Mm-hmm. And why is it more important? I understand that you have to have a society built on the rule of law. I believe in that deeply. Why is it more important in thinking about the rule of law for someone to immediately comply with any request of an officer than for that person to continue to live?
I mean, here's the thing. It's just like DNA evidence. Do you think innocent people were only sitting on death row after the use of DNA evidence to free them? Do you think every innocent person sitting on death row has DNA evidence in their case? Of course not. It's only showing a small percentage of the problem. And in the same way, do you think that the execution of innocent people by police officers, by Black men, by police officers, only became a problem with the invention of cell phones and cell phone cameras? Do you think a cell phone camera is always used when there is a problematic interaction between the police and Black people? Or do you think they are only revealing a small percentage of the problem? And I think to what you said about how we deal with this at White People. Listen, I understand that there is a lot of paradox here and it is hard. You hear, listen to Black people, but don't ask them questions. Don't cross-examine them about their experience because that's just another form of oppression. You hear, fight for policies, change the policies, but one policy is not going to fix it, right? It's not. There's not one easy solution to what happened to George Floyd. There's not one police procedure or one law that we can change that will fix this. This problem, this cancer in our country has been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it will take longer than every one of us alive today to begin to deal with it. And there's not one easy solution. And the most important part is we're not all starting from the same spot. You know, some people have been working in racial justice for their whole lives. Some people are just waking up to the problem right now. The lessons that have to be learned are going to be different for every individual. And the policies that will have the biggest impact will change depending on the community. And then there are also federal problems that can make a huge impact right now. I would start with reparations. But it's hard and it's complicated. And that doesn't mean we can stop. And we're going to feel bad about ourselves and we're going to get it wrong. And we are probably going to see more videos like the death of George Floyd before this gets better. And we have to live with that. And we cannot become discouraged. And we have to realize that this is a massive, massive problem. And I think we're used to easy problems or quick solutions or a consumption model where we buy something and it fixes it. And that's not what this is. That's not what this is. This is a messy, complicated power structure that has been ingrained in our country since its beginning. And we all have so much work to do.
I was texting with some really dear and thoughtful friends about how we all react to hearing, no, we're all racist and we're all sexist and we're all heteronormative because we all have come up in that context. And how is that a useful way to talk to people about it? Does that put them too much on the defensive? Does that alleviate responsibility? Does it dilute the impact of saying, no, this was racist? And we were having this discussion, and in my mind, I just keep coming back to a similarity between COVID-19 and racism, in that we are struggling with COVID-19 and our individual actions around it because it is a collective problem. And it is a problem that we don't have complete control over. And the control we have feels really uncomfortable to us. And I think that that is a useful piece of how we as white people can think about it when we maintain, deepen, become aware of the idea that we all are racist, that we all have this unconscious bias, that we all do things from a place of being part of this centuries-long history. And so, you know, remembering I hold this in me without any intention to, and also it is incredibly powerful. And the thing I must think about constantly is safeguarding other people from it and deepening my awareness of how I can do that. And that's, as you said, Sarah, so well, it's hard, it's confusing, it's complicated, and it's not something to whine about because I am not scared of my children having interactions with the police. So we got to recognize that it's difficult, recognize that it is much less difficult than living in a world created like this if you are Black or brown, and just keep moving forward and understanding that there are tons of policies that need to be fixed. I mean, we can take it back to our understanding of crime and punishment in the 1980s and 90s, which is the canvas on which much of what is happening now is written, when we thought that drugs were the most evil force that could possibly be part of the world, when our Supreme Court endorsed police conduct that is unacceptable and said that the only thing we need to question when we look at the use of force by a police officer is whether it was objectively reasonable from the officer's perspective at the time it was used. That's not a good standard. We've seen in case after case after case that that standard does not work, and we need a new standard. And if, as you apply that standard to George Floyd, even with it being an unacceptable standard, I think it is clear that this was a murder. It did not unfold quickly. It unfolded painfully slowly, especially for the people who stood there and watched it. The severity of the underlying crime. I mean, I could use a $20 counterfeit bill and not know that I did. Counterfeits are really good. They're hard to spot. You know, I don't know how I would react to being accused of using a counterfeit bill. And so there is an assumption of not only guilt, but intention built into the way he was approached in the first place. There's so much to think about here. And it is so hard and overwhelming when you start to look at our entire approach to crime and punishment and realize how severely misguided, how severely racist, how severely detrimental it is, how dangerous it is for the very people who enforce those laws, in addition to the people that they enforce them against. We have a ton of work to do. It doesn't all get done today, but you're right, Sarah, we're going to see more videos like this. It's not going away because it is not about one bad police officer.
One of the more encouraging parts of our current conversation about the death of George Floyd is I'm seeing so many people quote the work of Ibram X. Kendi, which if you've listened to this podcast, you know I love his work. And I think what's so great, particularly about that conversation about who's racist, are you racist, is his big thing is like, it's fluid. It's like a name tag you take on and off. You can have an interaction in which you reach awareness afterwards that you realize I was being racist. I was making racist assumptions. And it's not a tattoo, because then you can say, okay, I want to be anti-racist, because I think the real breakthrough of his work is saying not racist is not a thing. You're either working actively to dismantle racist power structures, to change racist policies, to raise awareness about racist attitudes and racist stereotypes, or you are allowing them to continue, which is racist. And so I think that the fluidity, I think that he sort of reveals and says, like, let's stop trying to categorize each other and think that's all that matters. That cop is racist. That cop isn't. We're done. No. It is much more important to think, okay, but with the structures both cops operate under are what we need to pay attention to. The policies both cops operate under is what's important. The power that is maintained by racist policies, be it in real estate, financing, education, healthcare, criminal justice, that's what matters. And I think, you know, because what's so impossible, and I hope everyone can see, is you can't prove whether or not someone is a racist in this 2020 America unless they're a grand wizard in the KKK. That's what we've decided. Like, that's the only objective proof that somebody's racist is if you catch them in the KKK or in a white nationalist rally. Otherwise, if they say, I'm not racist, if you're Donald Trump and you say, I'm not racist, then to a majority of Americans, that's good enough. You can't dive into someone's inner thoughts and say, no, see, what you're really thinking in your head is that you hate Black people. And somehow we've made that the level of proof. And so we got to let go of that. Like, individual hearts and minds aren't unimportant, but they can shift and change. What's really essential, I think, is using your heart and mind to do the work, to do the anti-racist work of overturning these policies, of changing these power structures, of doing positive things like supporting Black businesses, of advocating for change in your own school system. And again, it's good, powerful work, but it's not going to fix it. And we just have to get really comfortable with the idea that this is a calling, not like a quick mission we're all going to get on board with and solve tomorrow.
Yeah, I think you're right that we have reduced the idea of racism to pure animus instead of safeguarding structures that feel like passive racism to us as white people or not racist at all because it's so passive, and having to do the work of understanding that safeguarding a status quo that actively oppresses other people is part of racism too, even if you don't hold that animus.
Yep.
I don't want to gloss over before we talk with Governor Whitmer the fact that we have passed 100,000 lives lost to COVID-19. And I wanted to share today that my second cousin has been in ICU for a couple of weeks with COVID-19. And it's something that I haven't known how to talk about for a lot of reasons. But I think the biggest thing that I'm realizing is that I haven't wanted to talk about it until he was okay, because it felt too scary to talk about in case he wasn't going to be okay. And he has been released from the hospital today, and we are so relieved and grateful. And I know the people who love him closest and best are incredibly relieved and grateful. I was just thinking about that as I keep seeing the really great work that major newspapers have done to put a story to these 100,000 lives that are lost, and how intense my own feeling about him battling this has been, even though he's not someone that I see every month by a long shot. He's someone who I love. And knowing that he was there in ICU by himself and waiting every day for the text message that we would receive from his sister letting us know how he was doing, it's been pretty excruciating. And understanding that as a very small thread in this nation's tapestry of anxiety and concern and grief right now has been very eye-opening for me. And so I just want to share that I am certain that we have listeners connected to those 100,000 people intimately and distantly, and we're just holding space around all of the emotions that that creates.
You know, we love rituals to celebrate the changing seasons and the different celebrations in our lives. You guys, this year I committed to Olive in June as a part of my ritual. I really wanted to paint my nails more regularly, and I have done a great job. I don't mean to brag on myself, mainly because they make it so easy. It's really, really all about that Manny system, especially the nail strengthener, which I'm very passionate about. I just love using the colors to mark the fun things happening in my week. Lime fizz for St. Patrick's Day. Sequin everything when I went to the beach. Grateful and kind for Valentine's Day week. I just think it puts a little pep in my step. And they make it so easy with the system. The manicures last so long. It's like $2 a manicure, basically. They always have the most amazing polishes. I love following their Instagram for ideas about manicures. I just love everything about Olive and June. That's the long and short of it, guys. Visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's OliveAndJune.com/PantSuit for 20% off your first Manny system.
I'm not a research scientist, but I know that having a good hair day correlates with a good mood for me. And I have many more good hair days since I've been using Pros. I use the Pros shampoo, conditioner, curl cream, gel, and occasionally the hair mask. These products were formulated specifically for me, not for my hair type, but for me. What I eat, where I live, the specific issues that worry me about my naturally curly and very thick hair. Since I've been using Pros, I've noticed that I can go longer between washes without my hair looking dull or feeling oily. I've noticed that my curl structure is stronger and healthier. I've noticed that my hair has figured out how it wants to just lie on my head. I'm not fighting with it every day anymore. I feel like my hair and I have come to a peace truce. And that is really emotionally beneficial to me, in addition to producing lots of compliments on my hair everywhere I go. Pros is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/pantsuit. So get your free consultation, then 50% off at pros.com/pantsuit. That's PROSE.com/pantsuit. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Mine is at about 50%, and I'll tell you why. I have a tendency to overcommit. I want to help with everything I can possibly help with. I want to do everything I can possibly do. I want to be with people, and I forget that at the end of the day, I am an introvert, and I really need time to recharge and take care of myself. Therapy gives me important tools to do that, to recognize what's going on, to understand my battery and where it is and why it's there and what I can do to recharge. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/pantsuit.
We are so excited to be joined by Gretchen Whitmer, the 49th governor of Michigan and a longtime member of the Michigan House of Representatives and the Michigan Senate. Born and raised in Michigan and the mother of two daughters, we hope you enjoy our conversation with Governor Whitmer.
Well, Governor, we're so honored to have you here today. We wanted to start out by just acknowledging that the entire country is in a constant and overwhelming state of grief. We have the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery that we're grieving and processing. We've lost over 100,000 people to COVID-19. People are grieving businesses and lost jobs. From your perspective, we just want to ask, how is Michigan doing? How do you perceive the people handling all of this in the state that you lead?
So I would add another stressor that is unique to Michigan is we had a 500-year flood event as well,
where
we had to evacuate 10,000 people. And the next morning, the president took to Twitter threatening to take money away from Michigan because we were mailing absentee ballot applications. And so, you know, you add all of these things and it is a time of high anxiety and stress. And yet, every single day, there is a source of inspiration, whether it is an 11-year-old who made me a mask, or it is the people in this community of Midland, Michigan, who suffered this flood, who are reaching out and helping one another, or it's one of the incredible people that has been on the front line of this crisis every single day for the last 12 weeks and who's exhausted but has seen their work save lives. And so there's inspiration every day. I feel like Michigan has really, the people of the state, despite some of the protests that we've all seen on television, the vast majority of people in this state have taken this seriously, have made the sacrifice that we've asked, and it is, we're seeing that it's paid off and that we've saved lives and we've saved our healthcare systems, and we are now in a place where we can start to reengage sectors of our economy safely. And so I think that there's hope even in all of this hard stuff that we're confronting.
What we always talk about here on the podcast is you never get 100% buy-in. It's not like even during the Revolutionary War, there weren't people that either wanted to stay with Britain or really didn't care either way. Like, I think we have this theory that every single person has to have complete and total buy-in. But really, you can do so, so much without 100%.
It's very true. And I think that's a good reminder for everyone. In this moment, though, this is a public health crisis, and it really shouldn't fall along traditional party lines. And I think that's the part that I find discouraging. I think we'll get through this. I know we'll get through this. And I think we'll be able to find common ground on some really important, in some very important ways. However, it is distressing that in the midst of a global pandemic, there are political angles that are, I think, creating a lot of the confusion and the anxiety people are feeling. And it would be great if everyone with a platform could focus on the science and the public health first and foremost in all of the decisions that we have to make at the state level.
Well, I think that's, you know, everyone who works in politics or does policy understands you. It's this really delicate balance between the political capital and the public buy-in. And during a public health crisis, I think what's so brutal for people in leadership like you is that the stakes are higher, the timeline is shorter, and the need for that public buy-in is even more intense. And, you know, you had not been on the job very long, but I wonder, as you look back over these last few months and as the pressure to reopen increases and we look forward to the fall and we all know we're many months away from a vaccine, how are you thinking about that balance? How do we get the public buy-in? How do we strip the partisanship out of this? Do you think so much of it is trickling down from the presidency? I just, as you look back and you, as we move forward into the fall, how are you thinking about that balance?
Well, there's no question that the person with the biggest megaphone makes a difference, right? And mm-hmm. So certainly when the president singled me out for some criticism, it really changed the political dynamic here on the ground.
That's such a polite way to put it. I really think that was very grace-filled of you.
Well, you know, I've got to say, keep working with all of these people. And so I also think it's important that we're honest about what's happening here. Yep. The political dynamic in Michigan changed very quickly after that happened. The Republican controlled House and Senate went from supporting my executive orders to challenging them to taking me to court. I won in the trial court. I know we're going on appeal, so it's not quite over. But fact of the matter is, everyone with a platform can make a difference, can allay people's fears or can feed into them, can seek to find common ground or can divide us. And so I think that that's why it is so important that we stay tethered to the facts, that people like, you know, governors across the country are making decisions because there hasn't been a national strategy. And at the end of the day, it's these decisions that are going to, you know, save lives. And so staying tethered to the science and to the facts, I think, is the most important thing. But communicating with the people who are feeling this anxiety, who are worried about whether or not they're going to be able to, you know, pay their rent or take, you know, put some food on the table for their family. People who are mourning the loss of a loved one. We've lost over 5,200 Michiganders to COVID-19. And the trajectory we were originally on tells us we would have lost thousands more if we hadn't done the things that we've done. And so I do think that communicating regularly with the people of our country in a way that is based on science and fact and not seeking to just divide or score political points is really crucial to us keeping people focused on continuing to do the right things. I'm worried, of course, as the temperature gets nicer and people get more comfortable that the numbers have gone down, that they let their guard down and make themselves vulnerable to a, you know, a future community spread. COVID-19 is still here. It's going to be here for months to come, if not longer, and we've got to learn to live with it and be smart about protecting ourselves and others. And it can't be about politics. It's got to be about.
As you think about that public health and navigating the political dynamic, part of my own anxiety comes from the fact that just a few months ago, we were talking about this as novel coronavirus. There's still so much that we don't know. We know a lot more today than we did then, right? But there's still so much we don't know. Some of the guidance has shifted pretty dramatically since the beginning of this crisis. Can you share with us when there are conflicting models or multiple reasonable perspectives on the science? I think the big picture seems almost unanimous on how to handle this. But where you're making closer calls, what are your guiding lights as you make those true judgment calls around how to handle this?
Well, I think one of the things for which I'm grateful is that I've got some phenomenal, you know, some of the greatest minds in public health here in Michigan. The University of Michigan School of Public Health is one of the groups with whom we regularly confer and is helping us with our modeling. My chief medical executive, Dr. Janie Khaldun, is incredibly talented. We've been able to get on the phone with experts across the country, too, because I think it's important to have that additional perspective. And one of the things I'm most grateful for is I've got a number of fellow governors with whom I have built relationships that we can jump on the phone as well to share our thought process and what we're seeing and what we're concerned about, how we're navigating a particular issue. And I think that's really important. Information is crucial, and it's important to ask questions of the smartest people you can. And it's also important to talk to colleagues who are confronting a lot of the same stressors that we are. For instance, I know one of you is from Ohio and the other's from Kentucky. Both of your governors are governors with whom I have talked, just in terms of to get our arms around the data that they're seeing, the decisions they're making, to make sure that we're thinking through. And we're also sharing some of the things that we're seeing here in Michigan. Ohio and Michigan have this football rivalry, but at the end of the day, everyone in each state is better off if we're getting the benefit of both the Cleveland Clinic and the University of Michigan as mm-hmm. we are sharing our information and thought process and data. It doesn't mean we're all on the same track or the trajectory. It doesn't mean we've all had the same experience or have the same ability to take certain actions, but it does mean we're making better informed decisions. And I think that's really important in the stress of all of this, where there is so much new that we don't know and that we've learned in a short period of time.
Well, related to these crises, you ran on infrastructure. I know you've announced a formal investigation into the dam failures that we talked about related to that flooding. You campaigned on fixing the dam roads. You campaigned on making sure the water is safe to drink in Flint and throughout the state of Michigan. And all of those issues seem to be of even greater importance, a more accessible and quality healthcare system of greater importance given this crisis, and also really tough to focus on given this crisis. So how are you prioritizing issues as we sit here today?
I think that's a really important and great question, because we know we have to pull all hands on deck to confront the crisis that is playing out globally. And yet we also have to keep doing our other job, which is forging solutions on these fundamentals. One of the things that we saw early on was that there are a lot of people that just didn't have access to water. And we're telling people, wash your hands. Well, you can't wash your hands if you don't have water. And so we took some aggressive actions early on to make sure that we reversed water shutoffs, that we provided water where their, you know, pipes were crushed. These are things that we worked with local communities across the state and different organizations, but it was a problem that needed to be solved fast because of COVID-19. Now, it doesn't mean that the long-term solution has been found. It means that we've come up with a short-term way to meet people's needs in this moment. But it also means, as we're thinking about the next 5 yards, we also have to be focused on the next 100 yards. And so one of the things that we are going to be doing in the coming weeks is doing another kind of state of the state. One this year was back in January, and so much has changed since then. And then yet so many things have not changed. And that's why we've got to get focused on getting the fundamentals right. And we are going to put continued energy into all of those fronts. Because it can't just be about this moment. We have to be thinking about our long term here as well.
As you look back on your 14 years in the minority and the Michigan legislature, and as you're here as a Democratic governor with Republican-led state and House and Senates, what are the lessons applicable for everywhere in the country that's facing this hyper-partisanship? When you have these 100-year problems that need to get addressed, and you have this partisan environment that just soaks into everything, how do we deal with that? We get this question a lot. We get a lot of listeners who are switching parties for the first time, are confronting their family members about partisan politics for the first time. And I think it feels like such a Sisyphean task sometimes. And I have to think, over your career in public service, you've learned some really important lessons about that.
This is not always going to be a useful tool, but I do think that seeking to understand one another, right? The election of Donald Trump, you know, I went to the Women's March, which was when he was sworn in, and I had already declared my candidacy for governor because I knew Michigan went Republican in that election and that I had my work cut out for me and I needed to get started. And so I filed my paperwork for an election that was 2 years away on January 3rd of that year. I spoke at the Women's March, and someone told me they thought what I said was really controversial. Here's what I said. So we need to seek to understand. There are a lot of people who are hurting, and they voted for Donald Trump because they're hurting, and they didn't think that the traditional Democrats had a plan. Why was that? What specifically is hurting them, and how do we make sure that as we engage with people, we stay tethered to the things that really improve people's lives? It's a strategy that works with a certain number of people in our world, frankly. And I think it was Bobby Kennedy who said it when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. We must seek to learn. We must seek to understand. And I think that's really important. It's also grounding, because we know that there is a segment that is never going to be able to engage in a conversation because they're so grounded. And that's true on both sides of the of the aisle. But I think for the vast majority of people who are just working hard, they're good people. They want and expect their government to work hard and to be as good as they are. And they deserve that. And seeking to understand is an important part of it. Now, I always, you know, even tell my kids, there are some people you're never going to convince, and it's you need to cut your losses at a certain point in time. But the vast majority of people are open-minded. They're good people. And if you start from that place, you can really have some meaningful conversations that might nurture to both of your benefits.
It seems obvious as we are dealing with the question of reopening that a key to really getting the economy thriving again is childcare, safe childcare that's available to everyone. Is there an opportunity because of this crisis to work with your Republican representatives in a way that might not have existed before on universal pre-K or other priorities around childcare?
I hope so. I look at every challenge like this as an opportunity. We know that a lot of people are trying to figure out how to get back to work, and schools are closed and their childcare facilities haven't reopened. That's why we've tried to have a cadence where we could re-engage certain sectors at a time where we're re-engaging the child care commensurate with it. But at the end of the day, we know that we have to make it an investment in child care in this country. Most child care centers aren't going to be able to make it financially if we, you know, lower the number of kids that they can have at a certain time. And we know that that's probably what we're going to need to do to keep from having too many kids congregate and go in and out of homes. I've been chatting with some of my colleagues, and Governors Beshear and DeWine are part of the conversation, and we're all kind of confronting the same issue. And so it is not, should not be a partisan issue. I'm hopeful that we can find some common ground here because we've got to support these child caregivers so that as people reengage, that they've got a safe, good place for their children. And so I'm hopeful that this is a place where we can find some common ground. The CARES Act dollars give us some ability to do some of these things. And if we can find leaders on both sides of the aisle that embrace this, I think it's going to be really important for us as a country to do right by the children. Because we know there's real learning loss between the end of a traditional school year and the beginning of the next. What we're going to be confronting in this scenario is could be so much bigger. And that's why it's going to be so much more important that we have these additional supports for our kids and our working families.
So another big part of government infrastructure that is going to increase in importance in the fall is obviously voting in the general election, getting government offices opened up, issuing IDs, of course, the seemingly non-controversial, but in 2020 controversial idea of absentee ballots. What do you think is essential as we move forward as far as just election security? And then I really want to hear your perspective as, you know, a lifelong Michigander, as what got missed in Michigan in 2016 as far as Democratic politics and what you think is essential that needs to be watched out for in 2020.
Well, I'll start with this. This is some really good news. In 2018, the people of Michigan amended our Constitution to give the ability for people to vote at home without an excuse. Prior to then, you had to go in and sign an affidavit that you weren't going to be in town or there was some reason you couldn't vote. So it was not no excuse absentee voting. And so absentee voting was not really utilized very well here in Michigan. And you had to do it for each election. And so we hadn't built up kind of the muscle memory that other states have in terms of their vote at home programs. Fortunately, in 2018, we amended our Constitution to give everyone the right to vote from home. We are had our first experiment with it in May. We had a number of school bond issues on the ballot, and our experience was that, you know, people understand it was safer to vote at home because of COVID-19, so they availed themselves of it, and we had twice the turnout you normally would expect for the May election. And the vast majority of school bonds passed. So even in the midst of a, you know, global pandemic, people decided to raise their own taxes to support schools. And I think that those takeaways are really give me great hope about the ability of us to increase voter participation and to really change the outcome of where we are as a country and where we're headed. And I think that that's inspirational. Now, of course, we've got more work to do in terms of getting people to apply for the absentee ballot. The Secretary of State is taking that on, and that's what inspired the tweet from the White House the other day. But this is something that we know can be successful and can dramatically improve turnout, and that's something that's really important. With regard to the security, I do know that we, going into this election, have, you know, concerns with regard to foreign interference in our elections. And Michigan's a really decentralized place for, you know, compared to other states. We've got hundreds of clerks that are doing the frontline work. It is organized by the Secretary of State, but it's a challenge. And we are very concerned about security, and we're taking certain measures to protect the integrity of the vote. With regard to 2016, the turnout in Michigan that year was abysmal. I mean, it had dropped dramatically. And I think that's part of what we're seeing in our politics. When people seek to depress turnout, you get results like what happened in 2016. For the first time in many presidential cycles, Michigan went red. In 2018, we had a historic turnout, and I won my race by almost 10 points. And it was, you know, this incredible turnout. People are motivated to vote. And so long as we can give them the ability to do so safely at home, which we now have that chance to do, I think that we're going to see an incredible turnout. And I believe it's going to be very different than what we saw in 16. They're motivated. I think 16, part of it was Michigan was taken for granted. I think that there were a lot of different pieces that went into that. And of course, we know that all of the horrible things that happened to Hillary Clinton at the end of the campaign, whether it was Comey or it was Russian interference, all of those played a role. But our margin was so thin here in Michigan that I've really taken from that and used in my campaign that we need to show up. And I went into all 83 counties in Michigan. I'm not saying that our presidential nominee should do that, that you don't have the time, but I do think showing up is really important and showing up for the American people by staying focused on the things they care about, like fixing the damn roads.
Governor, I've been thinking about the coverage of you and sort of the fascination with you on the national stage as I compare it to the way that Governor Beshear, for example, is covered. And I am certain that there is a gendered aspect to that. I would love to know how you think about where being a woman governor benefits you and where it burdens you. I'm thinking especially of the really moving floor speech you gave as a legislator about the importance of having people who know what they're talking about writing laws. And I wonder where you see that really being an asset and where I would imagine it just drives you crazy, some of the things that are seized on to be written about endlessly.
It is. You know, I've been watching the Hillary Clinton documentary.
Oh, it's so good.
It's inspiring and it's depressing and it's the ups and the downs, right? And I think that every woman in the workplace has felt a lot of that, especially those of us who've put our, you know, name on a ballot. And I know, too, that we have a voice that is incredibly important. And my daughters, who are 16 and 18, I gave birth to one my first term in the House and the other my second term in the House. And they've seen this, and I know that it's made them stronger. It's also been stressful for them. But I think it's important for them and other women, older and younger, to see us fighting for the things we believe in and speaking our truth to power. The reaction in this COVID-19 environment has been very different in that I haven't said things that other governors haven't said. What I have said has been consistent with what you hear from governors all across the country. But I've been singled out and treated differently. Treated differently in a negative way from the White House. Treated differently maybe in a positive way from speculation around, you know, Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, I'm just doing my job. And I'm never, ever going to apologize for doing my job. When all of this started, when New York and New Jersey and Michigan and Louisiana were all on this exponential growth trajectory. You saw all four of us governors all the time on the news. We said a lot of the similar things. I was treated differently. And maybe it's because Michigan's a swing state. Maybe it's because of my gender. I'm not going to speculate about the motivations of the critics. I will just say that it was very different for me. And you know what? It's fine, because if you get into elective office, you can't crumble at political critique. You just can't. You can't crumble when the protesters show up. We have to make decisions based on doing the right thing and what the science is. And so long as we stay tethered to that, we're going to be okay. And it is a unique additional stressor on top of all of the other things that we're confronting as a nation. But I think, too, it gives us an opportunity to cut through some of the noise and to make sure that our voices are heard.
I worked for Hillary Clinton in 2007. I think her best piece of advice is you take criticism seriously, but not personally. And that is some intense wisdom that you see through that documentary that she has just soaked into her every cell. And it is very impressive.
Yep.
I hope while you're on Hulu, you're also watching Mrs. America.
It is. It's so good. I've seen the first three episodes and I love Kate Blanchett. And it's hard for me to watch something where I'm not crazy about her.
I know, right? She's so amazing. Well, and speaking of governor leadership, you know, female governor leadership in particular, our listeners, they need to know, Governor, is there a female governor group text? And will you share some screenshots with us?
I will tell you this, that I've had some hilarious exchanges with some of my female governors. Janet Mills from Maine is just one of the funniest people I've ever met. Laura Kelly from Kansas is so, you wouldn't know it just by seeing her public presentation, but she is so funny. So yes, we do have some text messages that go back and forth, and they're a riot. Michelle Lujan Grisham, Gina Raimondo, and Kate Brown. I mean, it's an amazing group that I'm a part of, and I'm awfully grateful.
That's awesome.
Well, we began by asking you how Michigan is doing. We wanted to end by just saying, how is Gretchen Whitmer, the human being, doing?
Thank you for asking. You know what? I'm okay. My mom would always say, if someone said, how you doing? She'd always say, I'm super deluxe. And it always got a laugh and always made it light. People thought it was funny and a little weird, but positive, you know, and I get that from her. I am an optimistic person and I like to make people laugh and brighten their day. And in this moment, I've come to kind of embrace the phrase, I'm hanging in there, because it's been challenging. And I think the personal attacks and the threats of violence are certainly concerning. I don't spend too much energy on them. I've got the state police that has my back, and the vast majority of people are really appreciative and agree with the actions that we've had to take. But some of the days can be hard. I'm not going to lie to you. But you know what? Every single day, without exception, there's a source of inspiration, and that keeps me going.
Well, I think you're probably using some of the techniques that all of us moms use, which is time goes so fast. It doesn't, like, that's what I keep telling myself on the most stressful days of this. I'm like, well, my 10-year-old was born approximately 8 minutes ago. So in a blink of an eye, he'll be 18 like yours, and this will all be over. That's what I just have to keep telling myself.
That's right. That's right.
Well, Governor, thank you so much for spending time with us and for your leadership through this crisis. We would love to talk with you again anytime.
Thank you both. Take care.
You too.
Thank you. Spring is so tricky because I feel the sun shining, the earth is waking up, and I want fresh, vegetable-forward meals. And I'm running in 75 directions and don't have a lot of kitchen and prep time. Fortunately, Factor is here for me and for you with fresh, never frozen meals that are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes. They have a ton of options for us, including keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, calorie smart, and so many add-ons. If you need help with breakfast or snacks or on-the-go lunches or beverages, Factor is here for you. Every meal I've had from Factor is so well composed, it's so flavorful, the sauces are delicious. And Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/pantsuit50 and use code pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code pantsuit50 at factormeals.com/pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thank you so much to Governor Whitmer, to her team, to the Democratic Women Governors Association for making this conversation happen today. We are really grateful. I learned a lot in that conversation, particularly about Michigan, and I hope it was beneficial to all of you. One quick note, Governor Whitmer mentioned that one of us is from Kentucky and one from Ohio. That is both accurate and incomplete. We both live in Kentucky, but if you Google me, everything that you're going to find about my life has occurred in Cincinnati, Ohio. And so if that was confusing, that's why. But it showed, I thought, so much care of her team to have done that level of diligence on us. So thank you again. We will be back with you on Tuesday. And we know we've had a lot of guests lately, but that's because we're living in a time that requires a lot of expertise. And so we're bringing back our resident coronavirus expert, Michelle Becker, to answer more of your questions, specifically about how do we think about getting out and about in the world again on Tuesday. Very excited to share that with you. And so we hope you join us then. In the meantime, keep it nuanced, y'all.
Pantsuit Politics is produced by Dylan Garvin and Studio D Production. Elise Knapp is our managing editor. Dante Lima is the composer and performer of our theme music.
Our show is listener supported. Special thanks to our executive producers, Tracy Putoff, Tim Miller, Tiffany Hasler, Martha Brunitsky, David McWilliams, Joshua Allen, Allie Edwards, Amy Whited, Jared Minson, Allison Luzader, Janice Elliott, Barry Kaufman, and Sarah Ralph.
To support Pantsuit Politics and receive lots of bonus features, visit patreon.com/pantsuitpolitics.
You can connect with us on our website, pantsuitpoliticsshow.com, sign up for our weekly emails, and follow us on Instagram.